I'm Jesse Thorne. This is The Turnaround. The show where I ask interviewers about interviewing. It's a partnership between Maximum Fun and the Columbia Journalism Review. Today, it's my all-time interview hero, Terry Gross, the host of NPR's Fresh Air. If you say the word interview to somebody, they're probably going to say Terry Gross back at you. She's been doing this show for 30 years nationally, a few more years before that as a local show in Philadelphia. And it's one of those shows that seems to get better with time. Terry Gross has been doing radio for more than 40 years. She says she prefers the medium in part because without a camera there, she can just be a voice coming out of the ether.
Invisibility is a lovely thing to have, in my opinion. And, you know, since I live more in my head than I do in my body in a lot of ways, I find radio a very suitable medium.
A given Fresh Air interview might take 45 minutes, an hour, sometimes even an hour and a half or 2 hours before it's boiled down for the air. And that gives Terry a special opportunity to look for the magical moments that make her show so great.
I feel like I can take chances I couldn't ordinarily take because I can ask something that I know, like, this is either going to get a really interesting answer or it's going to be such a total dead end. And I can try and see what happens.
Okay, before we get into this, I'm going to give you some real talk. This is the last episode of The Turnaround. This was the one that I was fearing the most. This is the one that I was sick at my stomach before I did. And also, I had taken my migraine medication and was literally physically ill when I recorded it. But I didn't want to reschedule it because I was worried that if I tried to reschedule it, it would all disappear into the vapor. So I have not listened to this. I don't want to listen to it because I am very convinced that I did a bad job. But Terry Gross maybe is the smartest, nicest lady ever. So she did a great job. I don't know what to tell you. You can tell me if I did a bad job. No, don't. Don't tell me if I did a bad job. Last episode of The Turnaround. Let's just go to the tape. Terry Gross, welcome to The Turnaround. It's great to get to talk to you.
And to talk to you. Thank you.
This is a question that is a clarification, perhaps more for me than for our audience. But do you this is something that I think about a lot for myself. Do you think of yourself as a journalist?
Yes, but not a reporter. I used to think that a journalist and reporter were the same thing. Therefore, probably I wasn't a journalist. But I think of myself as a journalist because I follow what I think are the ethics that a journalist would follow. I believe things have to be truthful and accurate, that there's, you know, there's certain journalistic standards that you have to follow. But it doesn't mean that I'm a reporter. It doesn't mean, you know, that I'm just, you know, I'm in an interviewer. It's a different type of journalism.
It's kind of odd. You're unusual in that this has almost always been what you did. Like, there was no period where you were filing reports for the Washington Post and then
exactly.
You know, someone at...
Right, never.
Did you, at any point along the way, did you think that you should be doing something else?
No, actually, because I felt that being an interviewer, that it just suited me, you know, because let's see. When I started doing interviews and I was in my early 20s, you know, I was really casting about for something to do, and it felt natural to me. I felt comfortable doing it. I didn't feel like it was beyond my capacity. I didn't feel like I had to know a lot more than I was capable of knowing. I have a very imperfect memory, and the idea of being a reporter was always really terrifying to me because you have to be able to say something with authority and know that that is the truth as you observed it or as you heard it. And I know I would probably always be second-guessing and going like, well, I think he said this. Pretty sure he said that. You know, but in those days, like, you know, I don't know if everything was being taped or not. I just know that you're like, you're observing things and reporting on it, and I'd always be thinking, yeah, but maybe that's not what he said or maybe that's not what I saw. And you can't be that as a reporter.
I've heard you describe yourself as shy. Is that fair?
Yeah. I mean, I always was shy. I think I've outgrown a lot of that shyness by virtue of the work that I do. I mean, I have to be able to talk to anybody about anything. But though that is under very kind of laboratory controlled conditions, it's not the real world. But I've, you know, I've learned to make my way in the real world too. So I think I've learned that there's a distinction between shy and insecure. So I think I've outgrown a lot of the shyness. And so I'd probably define myself more, if we're going there, as being still like insecure about a lot of things, probably more in my personal life than in my professional life.
If you felt shy and insecure, why do you think you ended up in a career that is so public and performative? I mean, you'd have a relatively non-performative version of it, but still.
Okay, first of all, you're invisible on the radio, so like that's good. If you're self-conscious, you've already eliminated a whole lot of stuff that you otherwise would be worrying about.
Are you subconscious about the way that you look?
Sure. I mean, not in a crippling, incapacitating kind of way, but, you know, like if I have to go on stage and do something or something on television, there's this whole level of like, oh, you got to go shopping and find something that looks right, you know. And I'm really, you know, I'm very short. It's really hard to find clothes that fit me. So that's just really a pain in the ass. I mean, I really like hate that part of it.
That's funny. That's like the one thing about going on television that I like.
That you like? What? Shopping?
By far my favorite. Yeah. Outfits. I love outfits.
Okay. It's not like I dislike them, but it's hard to find ones that actually fit me.
So, I don't like looking at myself and being like, oh, look at that fat, bald pile of mud. But I do think like, hey, nice outfit though, fat, bald pile of mud. So you don't like the part where you have to sort of present yourself?
I really like coming to work and not really caring very much how my hair looks. You know, mm-hmm. It's really nice to not worry about that. It's nice to not worry about all that stuff, all the kind of like, you know, how do I look today stuff. So I can wear, you know, like jeans or corduroy jeans to work every day and just like basically a t-shirt and a sweater and a blazer or something, denim jacket, and I'm fine.
Do you think that part of that is your experience that I would not natively understand as a woman? That like I get a much wider berth as a dude in terms of how I look?
I think that's probably true. And I think like women, and maybe more so women of my generation, maybe not, I don't know. I mean, you are judged so much by how you look, especially in your formative years when it's all about, am I pretty enough? You know what I mean? So do I have the right clothes? When you're really being judged for that in a different way than you're being judged, say, if you're on TV or you're on stage, you're being judged by like the people whose circle you want to be in or the people who want to be your friends or to, you know, be your boyfriend or your girlfriend or whatever. So, yeah, I think, you know, women are judged much more on that than men are. And even on TV, if you look at, you know, people on TV, I mean, I don't know where you live, but where I live on the local news, all the women, maybe I shouldn't say all, but like most of the women have like really like large breasts and they always wear like really tight dresses. And it's like hilarious. And like, you know, the men aren't being measured in that way.
It's very different here in Los Angeles, Terry. Yeah. Los Angeles is a very
looks don't matter
deep
there at
town.
All. I know.
Yeah.
You've all transcended that. I realize that. But anyways, radio, the invisibility is a lovely thing to have, in my opinion. And, you know, since I live more in my head than I do in my body in a lot of ways, I find radio a very suitable medium.
There's a way sometimes when you're sitting behind a microphone in a studio, especially when you're by yourself,
yeah,
that you almost, I mean, this might be too big of a claim, but like you almost dissociate from your body. Like you are, you know, you are listening, you are hearing yourself in your own headphones. It's an odd feeling.
Well, yeah, for me, I'm alone in the studio almost always, talking to somebody who's almost always alone in another studio in New York or Washington, L.A., Chicago, England, wherever. And so there's something very intimate about that because you're totally focused and you're hearing each other. You know, it's going directly into your ears from the headphones. So it's kind of being like, you know, injected into your body through your headphones. So it's actually, even though you're not making eye contact, there's something very intimate and direct and physical about it.
There's the thing that it reminds me the most of is when I was in, I guess, seventh grade, I had a girlfriend, like a middle school girlfriend. Like, we weren't, it was a very chaste relationship. But I would call her on the phone from my father's office, which was in our house in the basement. And, you know, like an old, the kind of phone that the phone company would issue to you.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, just sort of talk to her about nothing for a long time. That is the closest feeling I can think of to that feeling of having this voice reach out to you from space.
Mm-hmm. So you were alone in your bedroom?
Yeah, or I was alone in my dad's office. But
oh, your dad's office, right, yeah.
Sort mm-hmm. of quiet, yeah. Quiet, dark, private place.
Yeah.
Why, besides the fact that you weren't being seen, did interviewing feel like the right thing to you when you found it upon, you know, searching for some kind of thing that you do?
Well, getting back to the shy thing, you know, I'm the person asking the questions. I don't have to be, like, the great anecdotalist. I don't have to come up with stories to tell. You know, there was a period of my life when I entertained being a writer. And I realized, well, stories don't come to me. You know, I don't have characters that live in my head who I want to write about. And so when I found interviewing, I also found the stories. And I didn't even have to tell them myself. You know, because it's all about prompting people to, you know, share their expertise or tell their stories or, you know, just like reflect on, you know, their lives or their faith or their experiences. And that seemed very comfortable and very natural to me. And I do have curiosity, and I think, you know, I think I do have empathy, which is something, you know, as a reader, as a former English major, I mean, I think that's something that all readers really have, because when you're reading fiction, you become the main character. Like, you are totally seeing things through their eyes. You are in their body. You're in their head. They are you. And I think it's a very empathy kind of building experience.
That's interesting. Did you ever do the kind of radio hosting that required you to be the focus?
Oh, my God, no. Because, you know, I've always wondered, you know those kind of like DJs who could just like talk? Like, they're alone in the studio and they're just like talking about what's on their mind and what the weather is and, you know, the record and, you know, and they're just talking. And I always thought, like, how the hell do you do that? I mean, I could never do that. And even like, you know, the talk radio kind of people who just sit there and like give their opinions for a really, really long time. I always think, like, how do you even have that many opinions, let alone articulate them to like no one in particular with nobody there that you're talking to who's responding directly to what you're saying until you open up the phones? No, that's always amazing to me. I don't know how people do it. I could absolutely never do that.
I had to do that in college. I got an internship at XM Satellite Radio, and it was this weird, like, young people's talk station. It doesn't exist anymore for good reason. And someone went on vacation while I was interning there, and they're like, okay, Jesse, you're going to have to host the morning show this week because we don't have anyone else to host it. And I was like, okay. And I realized immediately, I don't have the I mean, I'm a reasonably opinionated person, but I could not generate the volume of takes that was necessary to fill 2 hours on one day, much less 2 hours on 5 days or 3 hours on 5 days. It was astonishing.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know how people do it.
Who was the first person that you interviewed that made like a significant impact on you? Like to the extent that they made you think about how you were living your life rather than just be in a professional headspace?
Gee, that's a good question. I don't know that I know the answer. I haven't seen interviewing people as like a form of self-help where they're going to change my life or tell me how to live my life. So that hasn't been a category in my mind.
But I feel like you're trying to learn something when you're interviewing someone, whether you're doing it on as an audience surrogate or for yourself as self-help. And once in a while, something slips through. I mean, it's an odd thing, but sometimes someone says something magical that shakes you. Has that never been your experience?
Oh, no, that's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. But I can't think of, like, the first time that that happened. And, so I don't know what to say.
Were you any good at it when you started?
I'd need to listen back, and I'm glad to say I don't have any evidence to listen to. I think that's lucky for all of us. But, when I started in radio, I was doing a show called Woman Power, which was like a feminist consciousness-raising show in the mid-70s. And we did some interviews then. We recorded people's speeches, and we wrote things and read them, like little essays about women in marriage and women in divorce and stuff. So I did interviews for that, but it wasn't the same kind of interviewing I do now. And then I hosted a show called This Is Radio, co-hosted it. And that's when I really started doing the kinds of interviews I do now, where you're like talking to somebody about their life and their work and trying to make connections. And yeah, I really love that.
Did you feel like you were good at it when you started doing it?
I knew that I enjoyed it, and I didn't want to obsess too much about whether I was good or not. I just wanted to do whatever I needed to do to keep myself good enough so that I would be continued to be allowed to do it. Like, my goal was, please let me keep doing this. So I tried to be good enough so that no one would say, like, this is crazy, you can't do this anymore.
I feel like often people ask me about how I like came up with a plan to have my own public radio show and stuff. And the only answer that I have to offer is just a continuing sense of terror, just a day-to-day feeling like this could all end at any moment. I better make sure that I do my best today. In the hopes that tomorrow isn't the last day. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, but see, I was really lucky because when I started in radio, again, in the mid-70s at a college station, it was an NPR affiliate, but it was on the State University of New York at Buffalo campus, which is where I went to college. But I didn't start this till after I'd gotten my BA. It was mostly volunteers. There were maybe like six people who got paid because you had to have a certain number of paid staff in order to qualify for federal funding from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So everybody was a volunteer, and you could literally walk in from off the street and start working as a volunteer. And so if I had to start in radio today, given how public radio has become professionalized and given how competitive it's become, I don't think I'd stand a chance. Because I did so much learning on the air. And you don't get to learn on the air on public radio like that anymore, which is a good thing for listeners.
Were there people helping you?
Well, you know, I was lucky because I was working on this feminist show with, you know, depending on the month, between with like 2, 3, 4, 5 other women. We all helped each other a lot and tried, you know, the women who'd been there longer tried to teach the newcomers like me, you know, how to engineer and do a mix and, be on the air and stuff. And then there were people who had been there a long time at the radio station. By a long time, I mean a few years. It was largely a college station with people who stuck around after they graduated. And that they were really, really talented. And they were also really honest. So when you did something that was bad, they weren't going to hesitate to tell you that. So there was a lot of peer pressure to be good.
Do you remember any
be good or be humiliated?
Do you remember anything that you learned then?
Yeah, because there's things, you know, one of the things I learned was, like, you don't necessarily hear your own mistakes. Like, I would do a mix and I think, like, that is so great and so clever. And then someone would take me aside and say, that mix was really awful. And I think, like, no, you're crazy. Like, listen to it again. That's really great. You know? And then in retrospect, I'd hear it and go, like, wow, that really was bad. You know, and so it's really important, I think, to have somebody going over your work in an honest way and saying, that might sound good to you now, but it's like, it's really not good enough. It's got to be better.
That's really funny because I had a very similar start to my career on a college radio station in Santa Cruz. I feel like all we had to drive us forward was a sense of shame. Like if we embarrassed ourselves on the air, that would be awful. But I genuinely don't think anyone at the entire station ever heard our show. Like it was on during morning drive. But like half of the station staff was, you know, dogs wearing bandanas. And you know what I mean?
Well, the people where I worked in Buffalo, I mean, everybody was just like loved radio and was so excited because it was such a public radio was so new and everybody wanted to be like original and do something that hadn't been done before. So it was all exciting and everybody wanted you. The people were really proud of the station and they didn't want you to like bring down the quality. But of course, we were doing this, you know, the women I was working with, we were doing this feminist show. And the idea of sexism was still pretty new to them, to men and to the young men we were working with. So when somebody would say, like, that was, if a man who worked at the station would say, that was really a terrible mix, my first reaction might be, you're so sexist. You know, I wouldn't say that, but I might think it. Do you know what I mean? And so you have to start thinking, okay, maybe they're not sexist. Like, maybe that was like really a, you know, maybe that was like not good enough. Maybe you'd better, you know, polish things a little bit better.
But it is, I must have been exciting just to have an arrow in your quiver, just to have a thing that made you feel like it wasn't just that you were bad.
Right. A reason to be self-righteous.
Yeah. I mean, in all sincerity, like self-righteousness is can be useful.
Well, yeah, I want to say the people I work with were really wonderful, but yeah, there would be always this sense of like, was that a legit criticism or was that sexist? Anyways, I really did learn a lot.
What was the first interview that you remember being scared to do?
The first interview I did. I mean, you know, and even more scary in a way than doing the work was listening back to it on the radio. Because the stuff I did early on was recorded. Like before I did a live show, because I did a 3-hour, after a year of doing the feminist show and then a few months of doing another show, I did a live 3-hour show 5 days a week. So, but when I was doing pre-recorded stuff, listening back was just horrifying. And made me, of course, realize, no, it's not just sexism. You got a ways to go. I think for all of us, when we first start hearing our own voice, it's kind of a terrifying experience. You never sound on a speaker the way you sound in your own head. Now, everybody knows this now because everybody records themselves on their own phone. But before everybody had a phone to record themselves on, the idea of like going into a studio and being able to record your voice was still, you know, it was still pretty unusual. And then hearing it on the radio, that was incredibly unusual.
How did doing a show live 3 hours a day change how you did what you did? Because that is a huge amount of being live on the air.
I think part of why that was a great experience is that it allowed me to try so many different things. I did so many interviews every day, and they I didn't have to reach for greatness. I didn't have to make any one thing be like so special. It's like, okay, that interview wasn't great. I'm doing another one in 10 minutes. And that one was better. Great. And now I have another one. Well, that one was okay. And so there was a lot of room to keep growing. And instead of obsessing over any one piece of tape or any one interview, I could just keep moving forward with getting the experience.
I did my show live for a really long time. And I found that one of the biggest challenges when I stopped doing my show live was to realize that I could do things that might not work. Because when you're live, part of what you have to do is make sure that everything at least works okay. Because you can't change it.
No, I completely agree with you. And one of the things I really like about recording and editing our interviews now, and I don't do the editing, our producers do the editing, but I feel like I can take chances I couldn't ordinarily take. Because I can ask something that I know, like, this is either going to get a really interesting answer or it's going to be such a total dead end. And I can try and see what happens. And also, I can talk longer than the final interview is going to be. I can record, you know, an hour and 20 minutes or an hour and 25 minutes even. And, you know, it can be edited down to, you know, like 45. So that's really a luxury that you don't have when you're live.
Is there an example that you can think of a risk that you took doing an interview on tape that you wouldn't have been able to do if you were doing it live, whether it worked out or didn't?
Okay, I'm going to go to that old standby of the Gene Simmons interview because, when he was saying...
Give us some context. If folks... I feel like when I mentioned that you were going to be on the show, everyone was like, Gene Simmons interview. But he was in a studio somewhere.
He was in a studio, I think, in New York, and I was in Philly. And he was saying, you know, his thing is being obnoxious and in your face. Like, that's among the things he's famous for. And he was doing that with me in a way that went beyond what I expected, saying things like, if you're going to welcome me with open arms, you also have to welcome me with open legs. And he was talking to me specifically, but to all women in general when he said that. And so if it was live, I'm not sure how I would have responded, but with the security of knowing, like, this is going to be edited. We don't even have to play this if we don't want to. We can just decide this interview is staying on a shelf. I was free to say things to him like, wow, that's an incredibly obnoxious thing to say. to say, like, is that your shtick? Is that the only way you know how to talk to women? So it just gave me the comfort to just be in the moment with him. And not worry too much about, like, oh my God, what's going on? How is this going to sound? What's the subtext here? What does he really mean? What should I do? I could just go with it.
Terry, let's hear a little bit of your interview with Gene Simmons from 2002.
Now, let's get to the studded cod piece. Do you have a sense of humor about that? I mean, does that seem funny to you?
No, it holds in my manhood. Otherwise,
yes, right.
It would be too much for you to take. You'd have to put the book down and confront life. The notion is that if you want to welcome me with open arms, I'm afraid you're also going to have to welcome me with open legs.
That's a really obnoxious thing to say.
No, it's not. Why should I say something behind your back that I can't tell you to your face?
Has it come to this? Is this the only way that you can talk to a woman, to do that shtick?
Let me ask you something. Why is it shtick when all women have ever wanted, ever since we've crawled out of caves, is why can't a man just tell me the truth and just speak to me plainly? So if I do that, you can't have it both ways.
So you really have no sense of humor about this, do you?
Oh, I'm laughing all the way. You know,
to the bank, right?
Well, of course. Don't I sound like a happy guy?
Do you feel like you could have done that if the two of you were in the same room?
I don't know that he would have done that if we were in the same room.
Right.
I've had several people walk out on me over the years. Nobody has ever walked out on me face to face.
Why do you think that is?
I think there's an element, just as it can be very intimate to talk long distance through headphones. It's also, I think, easier if you want to depersonalize somebody and act like they're not, you know, they're not a full human being and like you don't really care. It's easier to just go, well, the hell with you, I'm walking out. You're not looking the person in the eyes. There's, if you don't want to feel empathy with them, it's easier to not.
Your style on microphone is so warm and genial and considerate to your guest.
It's all an act, Jesse. I'm a cruel and thoughtless person.
Hey, I've had drinks with your producers after public radio conferences. I know what a monster you are. they really like you. They think you're wonderful. The question I was going to ask is it weird for you to have that skill set and that approach as a general rule when you are walking into an interview with somebody like Gene Simmons, who is in part famous for being a dick, and you have to be concerned, oh, what if it's adversarial?
I think every interview is different, and I have different approaches to interviewing depending on who I'm talking to and what I'm talking about. So I like to think that, you know, in say, if I'm interviewing somebody who is involved with politics, my goal is probably not like the empathy, you know, kind of interview. It's more about, no, this is what you said and this is what you did. And those two things like don't match up. You know, I think you have to approach political interviews with a kind of toughness. And I don't mean being like rude or crude, but with just a sense of like, these are the people who are responsible for our country. And sometimes they tell the truth and sometimes they don't. And it becomes your job to make them accountable if they don't tell the truth, which is among the reasons I don't do that kind of interview very much. Because I don't feel in the position where I can hold those people accountable. I don't know enough. I think on the whole, you need to be a specialist who follows these, you know, congressmen, presidents, vice presidents, cabinet members, whatever, on a daily basis, that you know the ins and outs of this really well, and you didn't just like study up on it. Because if you just studied up on it, which is the position I would be in, it's hard to really know where is the truth, where's the hyperbole, where's the out and out lie, where's the hypocrisy. And I feel like I would be doing our listeners a disservice if I wasn't able to deliver on all of that.
On another episode of the show, I talked to Larry King.
Mm-hmm.
And Larry King is a pretty amazing dude, I thought. I had never really been much of a watcher of his show, mostly because I didn't have cable. But he was kind of an amazing dude. And, you know, one of the raps on Larry King was always that he was soft on politicians, that if you're a politician and you want a friendly place to go, you go on Larry King Live, right? And it occurred to me that, you know, one of his greatest strengths as an interview was how sincere and open his curiosity is. And it's palpable when you talk to him. Like, he really is profoundly curious and will just say it. You know, whatever it is, he'll just say it. Things that I would be hesitant to say, he'll say. But that question of, are you prepared for the second follow-up, is something that was hard for him to do in that state. You know, when you're in that perpetual state of now-nowness, you don't have the notes to look and say, oh, but you said that OPEC, blah, 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 blah.
Right.
And it sounds like one of the things that you're concerned about is that your life, which involves probably doing, you know, 4 interviews a week or 5 interviews a week, you worry that you can't meet the standard that you would set for yourself for that second question
with somebody in politics.
Yeah, with somebody in politics.
Yes.
Exactly.
And the kind of personal interview that I like to do with, you know, like with artists of all sorts, with writers and musicians and, you know, actors and film directors and so on. You know, sadly, when you're in office and you're going to be running for election again, your biography becomes part of your campaign story. And, you know, people who are running for office tend to shape their biography to suit their needs to get votes. And so there's a level of candor that's hard to achieve in a political interview. That's my experience as a listener, viewer, and interviewer. And so I don't expect that kind of candor from somebody while they're still in politics. After they get out of office is a different story, and I'm much more comfortable interviewing political people at that point in their lives, because I think at that point they could be honest in a way that they perhaps couldn't before.
If you're offered someone on Fresh Air as a guest who you find unpleasant or abhorrent in some way, and for some reason the examples that come to my mind are one sort of almost profoundly trivial and one that the furthest thing from triviality. So the ones that came to my mind are if on Bullseye someone said, do you want to interview Pete Rose, guy who was banned from baseball for betting on games, or do you want to interview Bill Clinton, who was president and a very important president. I mean, all presidents are pretty important, but also, you know, accused of a lot of, you know, accused of sexual assault and things like that. Do you feel comfortable inviting someone on your show if part of what you want to ask them about is something shitty, something that you find abhorrent or gross?
You mean to have them on to talk about a terrible thing that they did?
Yeah, I mean, like, do you say, great, we'll ask Pete Rose about why he bet on his own team? Or do you say, oh, let's just get somebody on who we like?
Okay, so here's the kind of conversation we have, you know, backstage at Fresh Air. If we say there's an actor we like a lot, but we found out that they were involved with, say, a sexual harassment case, or they said something very, like, racist, like, which wins? You have them on because they're incredibly talented and excellent at what they do, or you don't have them on because in their private lives they've done something, like, really abhorrent. And, you know, in, like, artistic talent and a lovely personality don't always go together. So, you know, we have this kind of conversation a lot. And then my reaction as the interviewer is sometimes I don't really want to have to get into this charge of sexual harassment or this abhorrent behavior or whatever, because I don't know enough about it. You know, the person's denying it, but somebody else is accusing them. I don't want to have to go there because I don't know enough to trust what I'm going to be told. And at the same time, I can't not talk about it because everybody knows about it. And to, like, ignore that this happened would be really hard. So we'll sometimes just decide, well, maybe we just shouldn't do it. But is that the kind of thing you're talking about? Because
that
Pete
is,
Rose,
I mean,
there, yeah.
That's the conversation that I have with my producer, or that I have in my head with Bullseye, where part of, in my imagination, we're doing on Bullseye is endorsing the people that come on. Like, we have always described it as a recommendation show. If somebody comes on, it's because we care about their work.
Mm-hmm, exactly.
But there are plenty of folks who would look at someone who's done something abhorrent, and rather than seeing that as a negative for the interview, they would see that as a positive, because that's something that they can confront them about. Like, that's an opportunity. That's important, as well as, like, bad things are as important as good things. You know what I mean?
Yes, but it depends what kind of bad thing we're talking about. Like, if you kind of confronting somebody about, say, a sexual harassment charge, and you weren't there and you don't know what happened, and it's kind of, you know, murky because it's been settled out of court or whatever. I mean, like, how do you know? What are you going to ask about? You're going to get a pat answer. What are you going to do?
Yeah, it's terrifying. I asked Fred Willard once about I asked a question about that was related to his arrest. And Fred Willard's a great comedy hero and
he's a lovely dude. Yeah.
One of the funniest people ever. And I have no moral objection to what he was arrested for. And I had told him, you know, if there's anything that you don't want to answer, it's not a big deal. Just let me know. And he did say that. It's the only time anyone has ever said that to me. And then he gave a profoundly eloquent answer. And I was like, oh, man, Fred, can't we just run that? That was a really good answer to that question. I don't even remember what it was.
He told you off the record.
Yeah, well, I mean, it was implicit that it was off the record. I mean, he said, I'd rather you not ask that question. And then mm-hmm. he basically explained it with a very eloquent answer to that question.
Right.
And I was like, well, I don't want to, I'm not going to be a dick to this brilliant 75-year-old genius who was arrested for a dumb thing. I'd rather just talk about his work. But it is a very difficult decision. Like, I wrestled with, do I want to even ask him about that at all? And when it's something that is less dumb than what Fred Willard got arrested for, it's an even more difficult decision.
Well, but that's the other thing. You know, when somebody's had that, like, one, like, say it was drunk driving or something. I don't mean Fred Willard, but...
Right.
Sometimes people have that one thing that made the tabloids, and then for the rest of their lives, everybody's going to make them talk about it, you know?
Yeah.
And so, look, do you make them talk about it too, or you just say, like, they've talked about it enough, they should have the right to put that behind them at some point, you know? Maybe this is that point. It's always a difficult calculus, you know?
Stick around for more of my interview with Terry Gross after this.
I'm Riley Smurl.
I'm Sydney McElroy.
And I'm Taylor Smurl.
And together, we host a podcast called Still Buffering, where we answer questions like,
why should I not fall asleep first at a slumber party?
How do I be fleek? Is it okay to break up with someone using emojis?
And sometimes we talk about bugs.
No, we don't. Nope.
Find out the answers to these important questions and many more on Still Buffering, a sister's guide to teens through the ages.
I am a teenager.
And I was too. Butts.
No.
Will you change your mind? For too many times. Over and over again.
Hey guys, this is Adam Conover. You may know me from my True TV show, Adam Ruins Everything. Well, guess what? Now we're doing a podcast version right here on Maximum Fun. What we do is we take all the interesting, fascinating experts that we talk to for just a couple minutes on the show, and we sit with them for an entire podcast, really going deep and getting into the fascinating details of their work. Find Adam Ruins Everything wherever you get your podcasts or at MaximumFun.org.
We're back on The Turnaround. I've been talking with Fresh Air's Terry Gross, the best of the best. Let's get back to the conversation. I want to ask you a little bit about the nitty-gritty of how you do what you do.
Yeah.
How, in 2017, there are a few sort of secondary hosts or people who do interviews on Fresh Air besides you, but you're still carrying the bulk of the load. What does that mean in your day-to-day work life? How many interviews are you doing a week?
I do 4 interviews a week, typically.
So is that like one a day and one day a week is one day a week is like your meeting day or?
Yeah. See, Sunday, Tuesday, Wednesday nights, I'm preparing interviews. Thursday nights, the producers all give me materials from the people who they think are the finalists to become guests on the show. And I look at those materials, and then Friday, so that's what I do Thursday nights, and then Friday we have a marathon meeting and, you know, just kind of talk through who should be on and who should be on when, and scheduling is just like this really complicated chess game. So it's great for me to not have to prepare an interview for Friday so that I could do the other stuff I need to do to keep the show going.
Are you able to prevent people from bothering you while you're preparing to do an interview in your office? Or is it not a problem for you?
It's not a problem in the sense that everybody knows that there's times I can talk and there's times I can't. And, you know, I work with my door open. So, you know, anyone could just walk in, but they know, like, sometimes I'm going to say, oh, my God, I'm on deadline. Can we talk later? And other times I'm going to say, yeah, like, sure, let's talk. People always come in and say, do you have time to talk now? And then I give an honest answer about whether I do or not. So from my perspective, that works out fine. I don't know how they feel about it, but I think that works out fine. And people usually know what the schedule is, so they have some idea of when I'm really under pressure.
What do you do personally and what do your producers do in preparing for an interview?
Right. So I'm going to give you a before and after here. Until about a month ago, and we're recording this April 21st, 2017, until about a month ago, when I was interviewing an author, I would take home the new book as well as perhaps earlier books. I'd go through every page of the new book, reading it very quickly, just trying to pick out what I need to know for the interview. I'd circle everything on each page that I wanted to remember, dog-ear the page that I had circled. And then when I was done going through the book that way, then I'd go back to every dog-eared page and type notes on everything that I'd circled. And those notes would serve as my memory bank so that the next morning when I start to write my questions, I have something to jog my memory of everything I've read. And that's important for two reasons. One is I have a very imperfect memory, I always have. But also when you're reading at the pace that I read, it's kind of getting jammed into the file drawer. You know what I mean? It's not getting neatly sorted in a way that it would if you were actually, you know, if you had the time to read it very carefully and to reread passages and stuff. And when it comes to movies and TV, our producers, so Sam Brigger does the books. Our producers, Anne-Marie and, Baldonado and Lauren Krenzel, do the movies and TV. And if it's a movie, they'll go to a screening first. And then come back and say, this is a movie we should cover or this is a movie we shouldn't cover. And they'll suggest we should have on this actor or this director. Then I'll go to a screening of the movie or they'll get me a link to that film or a DVD of the film. And then I'll watch it before the interview. And then chances are I've seen some of this person's previous movies. But one way or another, they'll also show me like selected scenes from previous movies or from previous, you know, episodes. If it's like a TV series and I haven't like watched the entire series because it's hard. I can't keep up with everything. There is so much out there.
Terry, I think that just for journalistic ethics reasons, you should watch every episode of every television show.
That's right. Exactly. I mean, it's just it's impossible. Like we'd have a monthly show, you know, as opposed to a daily show. The producers, you know, do like, screenings for me, you know, like here's like selected scenes of something that, cause with Netflix now things, all the episodes go up like immediately in Amazon, you know? So they'll watch like maybe 10 episodes and maybe I'll watch two or three and then watch scenes from other ones that they've shown me. A month ago, what we started doing with the books, and we're going to see how this works, is that Sam, our book producer, reads the book and then gets the ebook, and basically cuts and pastes all the paragraphs that he thinks are especially important that I should definitely read, and he puts that together into like his abridged version of the book. And I read his abridged version of the book, which allows me to actually read it more thoroughly because the pages that he's giving me, like maybe 40 pages, I have the time to read more carefully than I read each page when I have like 500 pages in a book I have to get through in a few hours.
Do you look at other stuff besides those original?
Can I just give a shout out to Amy Salad, who does our news interviews, and then she sends me home with a bunch of like pre-selected articles about the subject that we're going to talk about, and then you know writes up some like key points that she wants to make sure I know you know, going into it that will help frame the issue for me. And then she talks to me beforehand to help kind of get me up to speed. And then I just go home and, you know, read for a few hours.
Do you read other stuff when it's arts and culture people? I mean, do you read interviews with them or listen to interviews with them or read profiles?
Oh, yeah, I read profiles. I read if it's a journalist I'm interviewing or a nonfiction author, I'll try to read other articles by them or about them. I read as much as I can, which is another advantage of getting, say, the help that Sam is giving me, or, you know, having Lauren and Anne Marie, you know, screen stuff and then show me highlights, is that I can also read other articles and, you know, look beyond that book or beyond that series. So yeah, it's good. I'm very, very lucky. I work with really smart, funny, fun to be with people, you know, producers and associate producers who are really terrific at what they do. And it makes my job a lot easier, and it also makes my job a lot more fun to do.
Your job sounds super easy and super fun.
Well, it's super hard and not always fun, but yes, but it's always made like better by the people who I work with in every way.
What are you looking for when you are reading a profile of someone, reading an interview of someone, or even reading their work or watching their work?
Well, you know, I've quoted this before, but Charles Laughton said about acting, people don't know what they're like, but I think I can show them. And I always think of that's what artists do for us. They show us what we're like. And so when I'm reading fiction or when I'm watching a movie, I'm looking for those like details that's like, yes, you've got it. That's how we are. That's what we do. That's what that kind of person does. That's what this kind of person does. That's what I do. This is what I've experienced or witnessed so many times, and you've crystallized it. You've captured it. So I want to know how you did it and what in your life led you to be able to do it. You know, that's what I'm looking for, more so than like the story, the plot. Like I can't, when I'm interviewing, say, a novelist, I don't want them to like tell the whole plot. Like that seems pointless to me. I want to use the plot, but also like those telling details, those character details, to get at something larger about the subject matter, about their lives, about what people are like, about inner life.
Are you concerned about the life of the artist that you're talking to first and foremost, or the work of the artist that you're talking to first and foremost?
I try to bring those two together. The way I think of my work is to see the art and try to kind of extract what makes this really special and kind of turn that into questions that can lead to interesting responses that will be of interest to people who haven't seen or read or listened to the work, because chances are it's brand new and most people haven't gotten to see it or read it or hear it yet. But to also use that to help me get to who the person is, and to use the person's life to help us understand the larger things that they've crystallized in their work. So I see that as a kind of like feedback loop, like the work leads to the artist leads back to the work, and you could just keep going like deeper and deeper, you know, into both of them in what I hope is a fulfilling way, in which you get something about both the work and that artist as a human being.
Do you think about the fact that you are doing a general interest show that often features 45 minutes or 50 minutes of content about one person with whom the audience might be almost completely unfamiliar? Much of the audience probably is, even if it's Scorsese or something like that. That's like the longest block of content about one thing on practically any electronic medium, you know, especially
except
in broadcasting.
Except for podcasts, yeah.
Well, yeah, but I mean, in podcasting, I think generally speaking, people are serving something that serving something to people who already know what they're getting and know that they're going to like it.
That's true. That is true. I think about it all the time, and so do our producers. And it's part of the reason why we try to be like very selective in who we have on, because we know that it's going to be a long interview, and it has to be interesting enough and of value. And by value, I mean like funny enough or nourishing enough or, you know, beautiful enough or, you know, entertaining enough or informative enough so that people will stay with us without having pre-existing buy-in, so that you don't have to feel like, yep, that's my favorite author, therefore I'm tuning in. You know, so that you're willing to give it a shot, whether you know the person, whether you know their work or not, whether you're inherently interested in the subject or not, that you'll give it a shot, stick around for a few minutes, and then decide whether you want to stay with it or not, and hopefully we will have convinced you to stay with it. But that means, and this gets back to the producers again, that means investigating not only is this person's work interesting, but are they a good interviewee? So our producers will often call the person up and kind of talk with them a while and see, like, are they an engaging speaker? Because no matter how good a writer you are, if you can't speak in an engaging way that makes people want to actually hear you, they're not going to stay tuned. You know, they're just going to find something else to listen to. And that, you know, that may sound cold, but it's a reality. And, you know, for people listening, they know it's a reality because they know that they tune out when they don't care. So, you know, and if it's not a person who we can actually call up to pre-interview, we'll look for interviews with the person and just see, like, are they an engaging speaker? And, you know, like some people speak in this like monotone that sounds like they're talking to a wall and like words are coming out of their mouth, but there's no sense of a human being that they're attempting to actually reach. They're just like flatly making statements with no energy, no.
Terry, I'm just trying to get people to keep listening to this show right now. I feel like that's going to alienate people if we have more examples of this voice.
Oh. Right. Yeah, but you know what I'm talking about, that really kind of like dull speaker.
Yeah, totally.
Yeah. Okay. I'm done.
I wasn't talking about you being boring, Terry. I wasn't talking about you being boring.
No, I'm done. I'm done impersonating being boring. I'll just be my own boring self.
So you're not boring at all, Terry. This is like very exciting for me, this whole thing. What about fresh air do people complain about, and how does it affect you?
Okay, what do they complain about? People are always, you know, people complain that something was too, you know, I'm trying to crystallize the kind of things people complain about. There's some people who complain about the grammar, that, you know, either I said something that was ungrammatical or a guest did. Some people will count the number of likes, like, you know, that a guest said. Some people will complain that a statement seemed to be like policing women's behavior or policing something. You know, every person who has a special interest who wants to be offended by something can find offense in what somebody said, whether it's about, you know, men or women or sexual orientation or race or religion or mental health. There's so many reasons to be offended, that people can be offended by something I said or by a guest, what a guest said. Though I have to say that doesn't happen that much, but it does happen. And sometimes I think that they're right, and sometimes I think that they're wrong. But we just get a lot of really nice responses on social media. Although I think our social media producer, Molly, tends to try to protect me from some stuff. I think what I always tell her is, like, tell me what I need to know so that I'm aware of where the real criticisms are that, you know, that are really important. But I don't want to be inundated with either positive or negative feedback, because I don't want to feel driven by that. I want to know the mistakes that I made. I want to know if I said something that was callous or insensitive. But I don't want to know like every single person's gripe because it can be paralyzing. You know, like if you're second guessing everything that you're about to say because somebody's not going to like it, then you can't say anything. And I don't mean like that might have not sounded right, but you know, I'm a self-conscious person, so social media can really feed into that that self-consciousness. So I feel like I have to limit my diet of it. How do you feel about that, Jesse?
I have a really hard time taking anything positive from people being complimentary, and I get unreasonably angry at people who say mean things. But I do feel pretty comfortable laughing at people who email me silly things. Like sometimes when people email, you mentioned people counting the word like, you would think if you're listening to this and you're not a public radio host or producer, that that's not a real thing, that that's hyperbolic. But actually someone counted the likes in an interview that I did just a couple of weeks ago and sent me personally an email, looked up my email. He emailed me about it. And that I actually legitimately find amusing. And sometimes I'll like Google their name just to imagine their life where they're counting likes. But yeah, when somebody says something weird and personal, like I get it upsets me. And then I have to remind myself that, you know, hundreds of thousands, at least tens of thousands, dozens in my case of people are listening and probably not all of them thought that. But then you do realize like, well, what if I really did say something lousy? You know, once in a while I do, you know, I've said things that were, the things where I'm dumb about it and I messed up, you know, especially around, you know, things that I should be sensitive to, you know, gender identity or something, you know, like that's something where I think a lot of people are realizing, oh, I need to pay attention to this a little bit so that I am being considerate of others instead of walking blindly. I make mistakes like that sometimes. That is useful. But, you know, I don't know. I'm still weird. It's Terry, like, honestly, I'm to some extent like still operate my whole thing like I was just a guy in my apartment, which I was for many years. like nobody at NPR ever tells me anything. You know what I mean? I don't know. I don't know. Am I doing a good job? I don't know. Should I be doing something differently? I don't know. Do you have a plan for your interviews when you're doing them? Do you imagine what the narrative is or what the structure is, the
Absolutely.
Discursive structure?
Yes.
How often does that go according to plan?
It usually goes at least partially according to plan. I want the interview to be a narrative and not a questionnaire. So I always try to figure out where should this start? What's the right entry place for this interview? And my job in the morning when I'm in the shower is to figure out where is this interview starting? And then if I can figure that out before the shower's through, I'll start figuring out the rest of it. But starting to me is always really important because if you start in the wrong place, it's going to be really hard to fight your way back to where you ought to be. And also I wanted to get off to a good start so that, you know, the listener will be drawn in. And so you have to start in a place that doesn't assume a lot of knowledge about the person or the work or the subject. But yet it has to be in a place that's interesting enough that people will want to stay there. You want to start with maybe an overview, but not so big an overview that somebody feels like they have to tell you everything in that one answer. So it has to be like enough of a appetizer as opposed to like, you know, a big main course kind of thing. And then you have to ask yourself, like, in a nonfiction interview that has to do with history, are you going to tell the story chronologically or are you just going to, like, pull out key passages? If you're talking about somebody's life, are you going to do the chronological version or a different version of who they are and their story? And you have to, in my opinion, well, in my opinion, my approach is to try to think through that beforehand and to have a structure that I think I can work with, and then to feel free to throw it out if it turns out that it was the wrong approach and it's just not working out the way I wanted.
How much does the structure come from the live recording, and how much does the structure come from the editing of the tape?
I'd say a lot of it comes from the live recording. But there are times when like the structure I figured out hasn't worked, and the restructure I've tried to do to compensate hasn't quite worked either. And then the producers just move things around. But I try to deliver a tape that's, you know, more or less in a usable, reasonable narrative form. But, you know, another thing with my interviews, I try to leave some time at the end of the interview before our time runs out. And our time literally runs out because we're renting studio time in a remote location. And at some point, your time is up. So I try to leave some time at the end for the producer and associate producer who are in the control room while I'm recording the interview to suggest questions to me that I neglected to ask. And that's a really useful thing to do because they're listening in a different way than I'm listening, you know, and I've spent all night and part of the day, you know, just thinking about this person I'm interviewing. And, you know, maybe the producer has done that too. Maybe the associate producer has. Maybe they haven't. Maybe they haven't had a chance to read the book, you know, so or whatever. So they can hear the gaps that I sometimes don't notice. And also they just have different brains than I have, and they come up with things that I'd never come up with myself. So it's very useful to do that.
Something that you ask people a lot on the show is how and why they decided whether to have children.
Mm-hmm.
Is that something that you ask people about because you think about it in terms of your own life?
Probably. I mean, I think it's now that we have the ability to make that decision, you know, because there's birth control, there's abortion, at least in a lot of the United States, there's the ability right. to have an abortion. There is an element of choice that didn't previously exist. I think for men and women, but particularly for women, it's a very consequential choice because, I mean, your life is going to be changed forever by that decision. And when I was getting started in radio and during my formative years in radio, so we're talking about like the second half of the 70s, the 80s, and I'm doing a 3-hour show 5 days a week because that's what I used to do when Fresh Air was a local show, at least in its first bunch of years. I couldn't imagine having a child and doing that at the same time. I'm sure some people could do that, but I didn't think I could. Because I didn't have time to do anything but the show. And so I wonder how people do it. And I wonder how, you know, I always am curious, like, how they've made the decision to or not to have children and how that decision has affected their lives. And also for people who haven't had children, I mean, I think we're past the stage now, but, you know, when I was coming of age, people would always say, like, I mean, of course you're going to have children. It's a decision you'll regret forever if you don't have children. And, you know, I feel like I'm here to say, that's not necessarily true. It's not a decision I regret. I mean, I know I've missed out on something very special. I've also gotten something in my life that I wouldn't have been able to have because I wouldn't have been able to have the career the way I've had it with a child because I would be a totally delinquent mother if I came home every night and just worked without paying any attention to my child. That would not work. So anyways, I think you can have a fulfilling life without being a parent. And I think you can have a fulfilling life and career and be a parent. And the choice is yours to make, and we're lucky that we have a choice. And choices are made to be used, and I'm curious how people make them.
When I hear you talk about your work life...
Wait, can I just stop you right there?
Yeah.
So you had asked me before what people complain about. So I ask men and women this question. But if I ask it to a woman, there's always people writing in and say, you'd never ask that to a man. Why do you ask that to women? Well, but I ask that to men too. So I always feel like, okay, that sounds like a fair question to ask me, but it's actually just based on a false premise.
When I hear you talk about your work life, Terry, the thing that I feel is not that you missed out on parenting, which I'm a parent. I'm glad I am, but it's definitely a mixed bag, and I can understand why someone would not be. It's more that I feel like I just wonder if you ever imagine what your life would have been like had it not been so subsumed by this one monstrous project.
I do wonder, and I have no idea. I'm absolutely no idea.
Do you still feel good? Do you feel good about the fact that it has been?
Oh, yeah, I feel really lucky. I mean, one of my life goals has always been to work less. It's a goal I've failed at time and time again. though I am, you know, at least the volume is less now. I used to do 10 interviews a week, and now I'm doing 4, so like that's progress. And the producers are doing more research for me now, and I think that's really progress too. And I'm really actually proud of that. But you know, I wanted to fall in love with work, and I did. So, you know, what can I say? It's to me, if you want to do a daily show, it's a pretty consuming thing. So I wouldn't know how to do a daily show without working really hard and being consumed by it.
I want to ask you one last thing before you go. We have still never met each other outside of this. And I'm reasonably confident that a big part of your life is not people asking you about me. But definitely a significant part of my life is people asking me about you. Just all the time. All the time. Have you ever met Terry Gross? What's Terry Gross like? Do you want to be like Terry Gross? Do you want to murder Terry Gross and assume her throne? all these different questions, right? And one time I was at the Public Radio conference, and I was hanging out. I was with Public Radio International at the time. I'm a different distributor than I am now. And my show was called The Sound of Young America back then.
I remember.
And this woman came by the booth while I was hanging around the booth feeling terrible and self-conscious, because that's the only way to feel, because no one at the Public Radio conference wants to talk to somebody with a show because they know that you're just going to try and get them to carry your show. So I'm just hanging around the PRI booth talking to the two people that I know. And this woman named Christine Dempsey comes by, who at the time was program director of WHYY.
Right.
Where your station is based, and is still works in public radio. Very brilliant woman. And a very funny lady. And she came by, and the PRI guy who I was talking to said, oh, hey, Christine, nice to see you. Thanks for carrying The Sound of Young America, which HYY was a very early station to carry my show, for which I'm very grateful. And she said, oh, of course. And this person said, hey, what does Terry think of the show? You know, does Terry have any thoughts about the show? Which is, you know, and they're just sort of fishing for a pull quote, I guess, a secondhand pull quote. And Christine goes, well, I really don't know. I asked her about it one time in the hallway, and she said the name was dumb. So I guess just confirm or deny, That one. That one's just a thumbs up, thumbs down situation.
I might have said that because I never knew, Jesse, whether The Sound of Young America was supposed to be an ironic title or a serious title. It's kind of like, for Pepsi, for those who think young. You know, like, it seemed like such a... It seemed like it should be funny, but I wasn't sure if it was meant to be funny.
You're right. No, I mean, that was what was so intense about that. I was like, yeah, it has a show with a dumb name. I named it when I was in college as a joke. And the joke just lost clarity as I came to have national public radio distribution. It was a lot clearer that it was a joke when I was getting up at 6 o'clock in the morning to walk an hour across the UC Santa Cruz campus and relieve the previous DJ, who was the aforementioned dog wearing a bandana.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Fair enough. Are we cool? We're cool.
We're
right?
cool. And I enjoy your work, Jesse.
Terry Gross, I'm sorry to have taken up so much of your time. And
it was fun to talk with you. I really enjoyed it.
Terry, I've literally been at the edge of tears for the last 75 minutes getting to talk to you. So that's sincere. I mean, it's a silly thing to say, but it's true. Nick, my producer, is nodding. He could tell. Fuck you, Nick.
Well, thank you, Jesse. That means a lot to me. Thank you so much.
Thank you for your work, Terry, and I hope I'll get to meet you in real life one day.
Ditto. Back at you.
That was Terry Gross. You can catch her 5 days a week and often once on the weekend on NPR's Fresh Air. Here's what I like to do. You can just go to the Fresh Air website, and they have 30 years of Fresh Air shows there. Pick any person that you're interested in, type their name in, and then listen to a brilliant interview with them. It is it's something that I've been doing for, I don't know, 20 years now, and it almost never fails. It's an incredible archive of material, and it will give you an hour of entertainment and insight anytime you want it. This is the last episode of The Turnaround. If you've enjoyed it or you want to know more, I'm hosting a Reddit AMA about what I've learned from making the show. It's the day that this episode comes out, Friday, August 11th at noon Pacific time at ima.reddit.com. You can join me there and ask me questions if you're listening to this episode in a prompt fashion. If you're not, you can always Google it, and you can always search for it and find out what other people asked me. Thank you to every single one of you who listened to the show. I'm really grateful to you for doing it. It was a kind of a passion project. We're not making any money out of it. Just wanted to contribute something to the world and learn something myself. I hope that you found the show helpful. I hope it was valuable to you. We're very grateful for the help of CJR, the Columbia Journalism Review, and we're very grateful to every single one of you who decided to listen to this weird, deep, meta show. If you know somebody who would benefit from this show, whether they're a professional journalist or an aspiring professional journalist or just someone who wants to look behind the curtain, I hope that you'll share it with them. We have edited transcripts of every show at cjr.org, and the audio will stay up indefinitely. If you liked this show and you haven't heard my show, Bullseye, I do an interview show on NPR. It's a show that I've been doing every week since I was 19 years old. So give it a listen. Find somebody that you're interested in once you're done listening to the full Fresh Air archives. And that's it. I want to give a special thank you to CJR for their help, their mission to encourage excellence in journalism in service of a free society. Again, we're really grateful for their help. You can check out their show about journalism, which is called The Kicker. Thanks to Mobius Van Chalkstraw for giving us our theme music. You can check out his stuff at chopsmusic.com. Let's do this. Come on, let's do this. Oh, let's do this. It was one of the side benefits of this podcast is that I got to talk to Chops, a.k.a. Mobius Van Chalkstraw, on the phone and get some music from him. He's a brilliant, legendary underground hip-hop producer, as well as a very brilliantly talented composer and provider of music to all kinds of things. So I'm very grateful for that. I say, like, if you thought the music on this show is cool, if you're like the music supervisor for something, I guess buy some music from Chops. But otherwise, go to YouTube or Spotify or iTunes or whatever and grab like a Mountain Brothers album, the hip hop group that he was a part of, a legendary underground hip hop group. We're so grateful that he could be a part of this. I created The Turnaround. Our producers, Carol Hart and Nick Liao, they have been busting their butts making this show happen. This is the first show that the two of them have ever produced, and I am so glad that they did such an amazing job putting this show together. The list of guests that they brought in to be on this show, and almost all of the folks who've been on this show were folks that they made the interviews happen, is absolutely amazing. They also put together every single episode of this show. So our thanks to Kara and Nick. Great job. Our senior producer at Maximum Fun, the woman who made sure that Kara and Nick did their jobs, Laura Swisher. Our managing director is Bikram Chatterjee. Special thanks to Kyle Pope at the CJR, to Emily Erskine, who helped us with publicity, Daryl Frost, also at CJR. They helped make this show a reality. And special thanks to all of you who listened to this weird show idea that I had basically in a fever dream and then spent a summer making. I'm so grateful. So thanks much. We'll talk to you again, or not, on The Turnaround.
MaximumFun.org.
Comedy and culture.
Artist owned.
Listener supported.